was noticing, actually something that had not struck me until Dr. Kavanaugh was reading the passages just now, that there's one point of cultural commonality between the Old and New Testament passages that kind of needs to be explained. That, I mean, I knew it comes into play in the New Testament, but I hadn't just missed it in the passage from 1 Kings. You know, you see in Kings, you have the bit about Elijah gathering up his robes, and then in the parable from Luke, that same thing, you know, recurs. You talked about the servants being, you know, dressed and ready to serve, and then the master. Because back in at that time, you know, in that culture, for reasons of, well, mostly dealing with the heat, the standard clothing for men and women was, you know, long, very loose, full-length robe, floor length, or, you know, just about, just a little bit, just a little bit above, and then kind of nothing underneath. You know, the idea, you know, as much air circulation as possible, kind of create a bit of an insulated space around the body. But obviously, with something like that, you can't move very fast, you know, which is why in that culture, the more important you were, the slower you walked. You know, grown-ups never ran, you know, especially, you know, rich and important people never ran. To work, to do anything, which you would have to do, I shouldn't say absolutely nothing underneath, obviously the sort of the basic as far as you know, undergarments, but what you'd have to do is you'd have to actually take a belt and belt it, whether, you know, a strap or a piece of rope, whatever it might be. And then once you had the belt on, you would take and pull down, you know, pull up the hems of the robes and tuck them in to the belt so that your legs were free and you could do things like, you know, run if you needed to, had much greater freedom of movement. Which is why that it was considered to be humiliating to, you know, for an adult to show your legs, because only servants did that, you know, only people who needed to work or who needed to run. So that's what's going on with, you know, Elijah, and then that comes into play as well in this parable, which Jesus sets in the scene of a wedding banquet in a very typical village in Israel. And it doesn't, you know, there's some things that don't come through real clearly, unfortunately, with our English translation, but the idea here is that this is in the public area of the home of the rich man of the village. You know, you had the one guy who sort of owned, you know, the bulk of the land around there and had the large house with sort of the private quarters for the family, and then, you know, area that was more for public use, you know, for hosting parties and banquets. And of course, those are always, in village life, in that culture, these are always very public things. You know, the idea of a private party is very unusual. You know, you have, you know, something to celebrate, and the entire village shows up. And so, you know, he is, might be his own, one of his own children. We're not really told that, doesn't really matter, but, you know, the big room of the house, the whole village is there, and everybody is celebrating. Well, not quite everybody, because back in the host's private quarters, his lowest status servants, actually, straight up, they were, you know, no doubt slaves, are keeping themselves ready to serve him whenever he leaves the party and returns to his rooms, which they're expecting will not be until everybody has gone home, because that's the duty of the host. You know, if you're hosting, you're the one responsible to turn the lights out, so to speak. And they have to stay up because they have to keep the lamps lit. Anybody here ever worked with oil lamps? Yeah, we've got Edith. Once it's pitch dark, I see another hand back there. Once it's pitch dark and you can't see anything, trying to prepare and light an oil lamp is a little bit difficult, you know, as you can probably imagine. So they have to stay up, they have to keep the lamps burning so that when the master returns, there will be light. They have to stay dressed for work. They have to keep their robes belted up so that they are prepared to serve whenever their service is required. And they have to stay alert so that whenever the master returns, and you know how parties go, you know, and how weddings often go. I mean, you could be talking, you know, the very early hours of the morning. You could be talking possibly close on until sunrise, but whenever he comes back to his rooms, they have to be ready to respond in the instant. That's the expectation. Well, the master kind of breaks the rules here. At some point, he slips away from the feast while it's still going on. And he knocks on the door. And that he knocks is actually how we know that this is in his own house, because in that culture, the only people who ever knocked, certainly after dark, were strangers. If you were going in the middle of the night to a friend's house, if you had, you know, need of assistance, you would go and you would call out so that they would hear your voice and they would know who it was and know that it was safe to open the door. But in this particular case, you know, there are two reasons why he knocks. One, why he can, because it's not an outside door. It's inside the house. You know, there's not any concern as to who this will be knocking. There's only one person it could possibly be. And he has very good reason not to call out, because if he calls out, then some of the guests of the wedding are bound to hear him and look up and realize that he's not in the party anymore. You know, his absence will be noticed, and he doesn't want that to happen. It's not a very good thing to do as the host. But he trusts that his servants are awake and paying attention. That if he knocks, they will hear the knock, they will realize that it has to be him, and they'll let him in. And indeed, they do. And they open the door expecting to go to work. But because they were waiting expectantly for him to come, they find a great surprise. The master has not come to them to be served. He's actually come bearing dinner. You know, he's filled a tray with food from the banquet and has brought it to them to serve them. And he sets down the tray, and then he takes a length of rope and he belts up the end of his own robe. He puts himself in the posture and the position of a servant. And this isn't even, you know, the ordinary workaday robe. This is, you know, the nice one. You know, this is fancy wedding dress. But, you know, he belts it up just like, you know, any common slave. And he points them to the table, you know, in the family's area where he and his family would eat every day. And he tells them to recline around the table. He moves out of his place and he tells them to move out of theirs. He trades places with them and puts them in his proper place. And he proceeds to serve them himself. They can't be at the feast because they have a duty to perform. And because they're performing it faithfully, the master brings the feast to them. Now, I suspect that most of you don't need me to tell you that this is not how the very rich treat the help. I suspect you're mostly aware of that. And you know, probably, you know, there are at least some of you here who've been in that position. I mean, does anybody sympathize with this? Has anybody been in that position of service to somebody who is simply too important to acknowledge that you were human? Yeah, you know, I've experienced this during our time up in the Colorado Rockies when I was pastoring a church up there. We weren't in the very richest part of the mountains. Ours was a resort community, but you know, more, they called it kind of the cheaper place to have second homes. And I did a fair number of weddings up there. I mean, you can imagine, you know, we had a nice timber construction church, you know, right out in the, you know, pines around it and the mountain out the front window. And you know, we have a lot of people that wanted to get married in the mountains. And mostly we were talking folks who were only up part-time, no real connection to the church. We didn't really have anybody in our church of marriageable age at that point. And as you can imagine, I mean, some of these people could have paid for my salary out of pocket change. I mean, they could have bought and sold me multiple times over if they'd wanted to do. And I can honestly say, I mean, I appreciate the actual couples that I worked with. I mean, they always, you know, had appreciation for, you know, the work that I did with them. But you know, their families didn't always see this quite the same way. There were some of them who very clearly, they saw me on the same level as they saw the people bussing tables at the reception, which was probably about three levels below where they would have seen their dogs. Yet we existed so that they would get what they wanted. We were really more tools to them than people. We had no purpose, as far as they were concerned, but to serve their wishes. And as long as everything went exactly the way they wanted, they were happy. And if anything did not go exactly the way they wanted, it would have been a lot less pretty in a really big hurry. You know, animate furniture was really more or less the point. But at that, as I say, I mean, we were just in Grand Lake. We weren't in Vail or Aspen or Telluride, places like that. I had friends who were out there, and I've heard some stories over the years of how some of the servants and staff and people worked in the restaurants in those communities got treated by the folks who flew in for the winter. The sort of thing that really could make you very angry in very short period of time. It's really very unfortunate. But this is the way, typically. I'm certainly not going to cast aspersions on everybody, but this is the way that the people who have the money and the power to be able to buy whatever they want, whenever they want it, and to dictate the terms of how life goes around them, tend to treat the people from whom they receive service. Really tend to come to see those people not as other human beings, but as instruments of their own will. It's a very common dynamic. And in this parable, the master turns this completely on its head. He goes completely out of this mode. And he serves his servants. He becomes the help to them. He lowers himself. He humbles himself. He sets aside his pride and his ego in order to honor his servants and to show them love. And this is why he slips out of the wedding. It's not just a matter of sharing the feast with them. You know, as generous as that is, and as far beyond expectation as simply that would have been. If that was all he cared to do, he could easily have tapped one of his servants who was working the feast on his shoulder and said, "Hey, you make up a tray, take it back to the rooms. Those guys have been up. They're going to be up for a few more hours. They deserve some food." No, that's not enough for what he wants to do. Instead, he goes himself specifically so that he can make himself their servant. This is the love of God. And this is what he did for us in Jesus Christ. This is what Jesus did in coming down to earth and becoming one of us. And this is why Jesus declares the servants blessed. He doesn't say they will be blessed when the master returns. They are blessed already because they are waiting faithfully and expectantly. As he does in the Beatitudes, Jesus is saying here that the blessed life isn't what we think it is. And no doubt, the servants didn't really think that sitting up all through the night doing absolutely nothing but listening for someone at the door was a wonderfully entertaining way to spend their time. I'm sure they had other things that they would have preferred to be doing, given their own choice in the matter. I mean, they weren't accomplishing anything. They weren't being productive in getting things done. They couldn't be doing their normal work because that would have disrupted the party. So there's not that sense of satisfaction. There's not even that sense of, at least I got this done now so I don't have to do it tomorrow. Nor were they having fun doing things they enjoyed. It would have been very easy, it would have been very natural for them to look up at the end of an hour and see nothing but an hour wasted, an hour spent doing nothing, not having fun, not being productive, just in a holding pattern. And yet, they continue to wait, and not just to wait passively, and not just sitting around letting the minutes drag, but waiting actively, listening and keeping ready for their master's return. And it is for this faithful dedication that Jesus calls them blessed. Why? Because they're waiting for the right person. They're blessed because their master is worth their faithfulness. You know, you wait, spend a long time waiting for the wrong person, and you use up all that time, then when you get to the end of it, you're worse off than you were before. But they're waiting for someone who is worth their time. And because they're focused on serving him, they have to say no to many other things which they could be doing. Things which would seem at the time to be much more enjoyable and much more satisfying. But they put their master ahead of all those other things. They make the choice to be unproductive for the sake of the one for whom they wait. And note this, it's for his sake. It's all about their master. It's not about anything else. They're not waiting up because they expect a reward. They only expect to serve. They are waiting because serving their master is worth the time. And when he returns, he proves that they were right to be faithful, that they were right to wait. He honors their faithful waiting, and he confirms their blessing in a way that makes all their waiting and all their self-denial worth it. What they receive from his hand out of simple gratitude and honor and love is far better than anything else that they could have been doing, and is more than worth the price of the hours that they spent. And such is the inheritance of the children of God, and such is the promise of the gospel for those who wait upon the Lord. Let's pray.